joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli once said, there is no greater risk than matrimony, but there's nothing happier than a happy marriage. Elizabeth Gilbert, best-selling author of Eat, Pray, Love, tells the story of her efforts to make peace with marriage after a painful divorce. In a new book, she talks about her struggle to understand what real love is in the real world and what it demands. Her book is titled Committed. Elizabeth Gilbert joins me in the studio after a fantastic report on you in the Washington Post this morning, really full page. And here you are in real life. Good morning.
Good morning. It's wonderful to be here.
It's so good to have you here. And I'm sure many of your fans are going to want to talk to you. Tell us about what happened when you finished writing Eat, Pray, Love.
Well, as readers of that book know, it ends on a romantic note. I met this lovely older Brazilian gentleman when I was traveling in Bali, and we fell in love. And happily, it was not, as my grandmother would call it, a shipboard romance. It was a true love story, and we continued our relationship after that. But both of us had been so scarred by very messy, ugly divorces in our previous lives. When we were under previous management, as we like to say, that we made a solemn vow to each other that we would never marry. We'd stay together always, but never marry.
And but tell me about that early relationship with Felipe.
Mm-hmm.
How did you meet him?
Well, I met him at a dinner party in Bali that was thrown by the other Brazilian person in Bali. There was a Brazilian woman who I had made friends with, and she said, there's one more of us here on the island, and he's having a party, and you never want to miss a party that's thrown by a Brazilian. So I went, and it started as a very quiet friendship and then evolved into attraction, and then, much to our surprise, turned into love, which I think is a nice, modest, quiet way to do it, and rather the opposite of how I have done it for most of my life.
And you both felt very strongly that marriage was out of the question.
Out of the question. And the fact that we were not going to have children, I think, was another reason that we didn't see any necessary impulse in terms of making a legal union. And the thing that I found, I guess there were two reasons. One is that I didn't want to jinx it. I didn't want to change anything about the terms of our relationship because it seemed to be working so well. And the second thing is that having gone through a bad divorce in the state of New York, which is a particularly nasty place to get a divorce, I had realized something that I think people don't realize on the occasion of their wedding. When you sign that little piece of paper and turn it over to the state, you are making a contract with the state, and you cannot leave that relationship without the permission of a judge.
How messy was that divorce?
It was bad. I mean, I say in the book, on Rebecca West has a great line. She said, normally all divorces are about as useful an occupation as breaking extremely valuable china. It was about that pleasant. And it just took a long time. I wasn't let go very easily from my marriage. I had to struggle to get out of it. And it took me about a year and a half. And I felt quite imprisoned, weirdly, not even so much by my ex-husband, although that was why it was happening, but by the fact that I couldn't get out of the court system. I was waiting for a permission slip from the principal to be able to go on with my life.
Did you feel it would be even difficult for you to fall in love?
Certainly for a while after that, although my nature, I think, overcame my hesitations
you're
in that regard.
I am, you're warm, you're outgoing.
I like men. I like companionship.
Sure.
And I like all of those things.
So what happened with Felipe to allow you and he to sort of get over those concerns you both had?
Well, one thing that was to our benefit in the beginning was that we lived on different sides of the world. And so, you know, we couldn't really impale ourselves on each other's lives in this immediate way. We had natural obstacles. You know, sometimes it would be 2 months before we would be able to see each other or find a country in which to meet. And I think that gradualness and the safety almost of those barriers gave us time to exhale between encounters and think, okay, that wasn't so bad. We can keep going. We can continue. So we sort of inched toward intimacy, and the book Committed begins where we have somewhat settled in the suburbs of Philadelphia. He very nicely gave up Bali for Philly for me, which I thought was a big gesture on anybody's account.
So then he kept traveling back and forth to this country.
Right. He came back and forth into the United States to see me, but he's not an American citizen, and his visa was a tourist's visa, which is not intended for indefinite consecutive visits. And we discovered that at the Dallas-Fort Worth airport one day when we were coming back into the country
that
from an overseas trip.
That must have been a fascinating encounter.
Fascinating is one word for it. It was terrifying. The Homeland Security people took him away, interrogated him for 6 hours, put him in jail, and kicked him out of the country. And the only way I could get him back was to marry him. We like to say that we were effectively sentenced to wed, a shotgun wedding with the INS holding the other end of the shotgun.
But, I mean, this all happened as you were simply going through the gate?
Yeah, coming back in, coming back into the country, I was going through a line of my fellow repatriating American citizens, and he was coming in the foreign line, and they just came with uniforms and led him away, which in the late years of the Bush administration was a frightening thing to have happen. And and I realized then the fragility of our union, because I kept saying to the Homeland Security officers, I need some information about my boyfriend. And in a situation like that, may I say, there is nothing more feeble sounding than the word boyfriend.
Yeah. So how long did they hold him?
For 6 hours. And then they let me come in and they informed us that he couldn't come to the United States anymore. And this officer, who was actually quite sympathetic, let us know that the only way, that the fastest and really the only way that I could get him back in the country was to marry him. So it was a very odd proposal, much more out of Kafka than Austin.
So did he have to then turn around, go back?
Yeah. They put him on a plane the next morning after a night in jail and sent him to Australia because he has an Australian passport. They gave him a choice of his two passports and he went to Australia.
And where did you go?
I went home, packed up our house, put everything into storage, and then went and met him on the other side of the world. And we spent the next 10 months traveling through Southeast Asia because it was the cheapest place in the world we could go and wait this out. We didn't know how long it would take to get the proper visas to bring him back into the country.
But and you'd have to marry first.
No, well, you're actually not allowed to marry first. That puts you in a longer line of people who disobeyed the Homeland Security. You have to get permission to marry. You need to apply for something called a fiancé visa. And if they like him, they will give you this visa. It's very parental.
I was about to say a mother-in-law, father-in-law standing
It's very much, if you want to live under this roof, young lady, you must live by these rules. And so you get it. And then he's granted a 30-day visa wherein he is given permission to marry me and only me and must. And if he doesn't, he's kicked out of the country forever.
Wow.
Yeah.
Elizabeth, I have to tell you a funny story. My husband and I, who just celebrated our 50th wedding anniversary, have always thought that the most ideal situation would be for us to live in adjoining apartments and visit each other now and then, because marriage is hard.
It is hard. Make spaces in your togetherness is the
exactly.
famous line. Yeah,
exactly.
That sounds like a wise. And as you get older, probably even more so. And I think it's interesting that your husband even longs for that, because some of the statistics that I uncovered in my research show that men typically end up much more satisfied in their marriages than women do. And it's an irony because, of course, the cliche, and I don't think it's without merit, is that it's young women who are pushing to marry and young men who are resisting it. And you look years down the road and it's women who are not only less content in their marriage, but less healthy than single women, less prosperous, and as we just learned in the New York Times a few days ago, more overweight. I mean, it doesn't seem to be anything, you know, there's all
no
sorts
advantages.
Of, you know, there's not a lot of advantages, more subject to depression and alcoholism than single women. And married men prosper to a degree that puts them far above single men in every regard.
So how do you feel about this change in your life?
Well, I was encouraged reading the big Rutgers study on marriage that just came out recently to discover I'm in a pretty good demographic in terms of my situation and getting married. I'm 40 years old. I'm not 20.
He's 17
years. He's 17 years older. We don't have children. Couples with small children at home report much more stress in their marriages for reasons I'm certain I don't have to explain to anybody who has small children at home. And, you know, I'm educated. I have my economic autonomy. I have a life outside the home. All of these things add up to the odds that I will have a good and strong marriage. So I lean on that.
Elizabeth Gilbert, she's author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Eat, Pray, Love, her new book with a big fat wedding ring, gold wedding ring, inscribed "Committed" on the cover. Do join us. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. I found it interesting that what you said about doing was studying marriage while you were traveling, waiting for everything to change.
It had two purposes. One, it helped us kill time. We had 10 months with nothing to do and in a very anxious state of anticipation about whether we could secure this visa. And the second thing was, you know, when I got married for the first time, I was engaged at the age of 23. And like many young people, I, as my sister put it, leapt into marriage the way a Labrador retriever jumps into a swimming pool with exactly that much pre-consideration and foresight. And I thought, it can't harm me to do it with a little bit more care.
It's a good thing you all had some money. And
yes,
money makes a huge difference. We're going to take a short break in our conversation with Elizabeth Gilbert. The new book is titled Committed. And we're back with Elizabeth Gilbert, whose best-selling book, Eat, Pray, Love, spent more than 100 weeks on the bestseller list. Now she has the afterword, and the book is titled Committed, A Skeptic Makes Peace with Marriage. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. I want to take you back a little bit. Why do you think that divorce is at such a high rate here in this country?
I think there are two reasons from what I was able to gather. It's good to recognize we have the highest divorce rates in the Western world. We marry more and divorce more than anybody in the industrialized world. The first reason, I think, is because we get married too young, frankly. Marriage in the United States is still a sort of shortcut to social respectability. You get to jump to the front of the line and get this badge of adulthood. And unfortunately, it's still sort of fetishized in that way, that it's maybe the only way to get that. And I think people rush into it because they want that very much. And the divorce rates for people who get married below the age of 25 hover more around 80% than 50. Blows the curve for everybody else. So I found it very encouraging to know that if you wait long enough, you actually have a very, very good chance of staying married forever. The second reason is that we have overburdened this institution with the highest set of expectations the world has ever seen for what marriage is. And for most of time and most of history, it's been an extremely pragmatic union based on the stability of the family, the community, financial considerations, and the production of heirs. And we have taken all of that and reduced it to something as ephemeral and dangerous as love. And I think most people throughout most of time would think we were insane to risk our families and our futures and our property for something as delicate as romantic affection.
You know, this idea of expectations and the reality versus the expectations is really, really central. I think young people, and I do agree that people married too young go into marriage expecting that what happens on the wedding day, which is going to be glorious, is going to signal forever. It doesn't. The practicalities of living with some other human being, one other human being, become really, really difficult.
I think there's also a tendency, especially among the young and especially in a country that has fetishized weddings, to mistake a wedding for a marriage.
Yep.
And I think a lot of young women, especially, when they say that they want to get married, I think what they really mean is that they want to have a wedding.
Yeah.
And who can blame them?
Yeah.
You know, it's wonderful to be. And one thing, I've never had that fantasy. And so I talk to a lot of my single young friends about that. You know, what is the impulse behind that? And it was really illuminating for me to have one of my friends say, it's a fantasy of public recognition that you have been chosen.
Ah.
And for somebody who may have felt unprecious for her entire life, the idea of being dressed like a princess and paraded through town in this glorious spectacle signals to yourself and to everybody else that you are precious enough to have been selected.
Now, the first time you were married, was it a grand affair?
It was a big party.
Huh?
I had a wonderful first wedding, and I like to keep that memory pure because I think sometimes when marriages go sour, we darken every memory of it. And that was a great day, but it wasn't a big white wedding.
What about the second one?
The second one was intimate and immediate and a bit of an emergency, and sobering and lovely, and I think where the first one was a reflection of the best of what my ex-husband and I were. We threw terrific parties. It was a fabulous party. It was a celebration of us and our socialness. Mm. I think the second marriage was more about a realization that we were now joining not only our lives together, but our families together, and that whatever became of us would have enormous consequences for our family.
What did your family think when they first met Felipe?
Oh, they loved him. They loved him. As my sister said, he's the first adult my sister has ever been with. And that's probably because I had recently graduated into adulthood myself. So they're delighted with them.
And as you studied marriage in different cultures, what did you learn about how Americans really are different from others?
Well, the one really striking thing is that since the Industrial Revolution and the invention of the middle class, the idea of linking love to marriage has become extremely widespread in the Western world, and it is a luxury. It's an economic luxury. If you can afford to throw away ideas about your financial stability and the future of your community, then you can take that risk. But prior to the middle of the 1800s, that wasn't possible for anybody, or for very few people. And in the rest of the world to this day, there's still a great deal more pragmatism about those sorts of unions. The other thing I learned is that Americans still elevate the state of marriage to the highest degree in the Western world. You don't see this in Europe and in Scandinavia. I was startled to discover that, for instance, in Sweden, a child born to unmarried parents has a greater chance of spending the rest of his life with those parents than a child born to married parents in America.
Interesting.
The unit of stability in Europe is the family. The unit of reverence in America is the married couple. And we've elevated this idea of marriage so high that the example I love to cite is this idea that while we were able to elect a black president to the presidency of the United States, I very much doubt we would ever be able to elect a single president. I think that Americans would universally regard such a person, whatever their gender or background, as being very suspicious. Why are you not married? Why are you not an adult? Why are you not a real citizen? And they don't have that so much in the rest of Europe.
Now, running through certainly your first book and this book as well is your desire, your need for continuing autonomy. Mm-hmm. How did you and Felipe manage that? Or did your feelings about autonomy change?
I found a wonderful philosopher, Otto Makard, who wrote a lot about this myth that we've developed recently in the West about the fact that we should somehow magically be able to maintain both connection and autonomy in our relationships simultaneously. It's a dream. And the magical word that we associate with that dream is the word balance, that somehow we should be able to have all the comfort and all the security and stability of union without sacrificing anything of our individuality in return. And you're laughing and smiling, but we know, right? Isn't that what we want? Isn't that what you want? To live in adjoining apartments with And I think that reading that somehow opened my eyes to perhaps being a little bit more realistic about the fact that nothing is gained without something being sacrificed. And it is a bit naive for me to even begin to claim that in my married life I will be as autonomous as I was in my single life. I'm not, for instance, about to set off for a year-long journey by myself,
exactly,
as I did in Eat, Pray, Love. I could insist on doing that, but the damage that would do to our union would be catastrophic. A month, maybe, 2 months. But if I continually ask for that, or if he continually refuses it, we've got trouble. So I call it the furry handcuffs. It's a sort of delicate relationship where you release and confine each other.
But I'm fascinated that you use the word ask, mm-hmm, and refuse, mm-hmm, rather than simply the two of us would agree that I would go off.
I mean it mutually, though, because I would no more expect him to come to me and announce that he was going traveling for 2 months without my permission.
Right.
And the fact is that love is a confining thing. You know, all of the joy and expansion in our hearts that we feel when we fall in love is matched by the inevitable restrictions that we place on each other.
How much did you really, really know about Felipe before you and he began this close relationship?
Before we became intimate, mm-hmm, or before we got married?
No, before you became intimate.
We had about 6 weeks of going out to dinner every night and talking a lot. I wouldn't say that that was, for me, I would say that that was a long courtship. I'm sorry to admit. For me, that was a slow slide.
It was slow slide. And you began to understand his family?
I met his family shortly after that. And I think that that was a big leap for me, where I had just seen that we were having a romance and I wasn't at all convinced that it would be anything permanent, although it was lovely. When I met his adult children who live in Australia and suddenly got to see the connections that he has and the great love that they had for him and the wonderful people that he had created and the bonds that existed there, it started to come into a perspective for me of realizing, oh, this is a serious human being with whom one could create a serious life. This is somebody who respects his obligations and commitments and is loyal and adoring and adored. And that seemed to push it into the next level. And for him as well, when he met my family, there's something about the starkness sometimes of modern marriages that are so distanced from family and community, where two people are in a vacuum of their own company that I think puts huge strains of expectation on each other. And somehow we've always seemed to know that what we were doing was joining two clans. Mm.
Tell me about what you thought you brought to the second marriage that you lacked in the first.
How much time do we have?
I know what you mean.
I mean, it's the difference between what you are capable of bringing to any situation when you're in your early 20s and when you're in your late 30s. And I could tell you what I was like at that time, but does anybody really want to listen to somebody in their early 20s talk about themselves, which is what it would essentially be? I was careless and reckless and romantic and impulsive and cocky, I would say, when I was really young. And one of the mistakes I think that I made in my first marriage was this assumption that we can shape this thing however we want. You know, this whatever the statistics might say, whatever the rules are, whatever the history of this institution is, we own this thing, you know, and we're going to do it anything we want with it. And in fact, marriage is a lot older than me. It's a lot deeper than me. It has, you know, deep psychological and social roots. It alters things, and it alters the way you're received and perceived by society as a whole. And I think I'm going into the second marriage with a great deal more humility.
Do you believe that Felipe has also come to marriage with a whole new set of principles as well as ideas?
I think so. I think he was better at it the first time around than I was anyway. But I think he has said to me many times, you know, in reference to our age difference, I could not have been the husband to you at 40 that I am at 57. I still was too overcome with my own ego, my own ambitions, my own desires. It is much easier for me to bow away and let you live your life in as grand a way as you would like to without interference. And
do you think the fact that you have married again has somehow disappointed those women out there who so identified with you as a single divorced woman?
I will have to ask them. I don't know. I do know, this is a strange thing to say, I almost wish that it would, except I'm afraid it's quite the opposite. I think there's still such a dream in people to find a mate and a partner. And when I go to book signings and I say I married the Brazilian guy, there's usually the standing ovation that I always find a little confusing. Like, is that a huge accomplishment? You know, I'd rather be ovated for other things besides having secured a husband. But I think that we all still dream of the happy ending.
Elizabeth Gilbert, her new book is titled Committed: A Skeptic Makes Peace with Marriage, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We've got lots of callers. We'll go to the phones first to Phoenix, Arizona. Good morning, Karen. You're on the air.
Oh, my gosh. Good morning.
Good morning.
I can't believe I'm talking to either one of you.
Go right ahead, please.
Elizabeth, I love your book, and I would love to thank you for being so brave in writing it and peeling back the layers of being such a strong woman and showing us your vulnerable parts. And I just want you to know that book for me was a rock for so many times in my life lately and to a lot of other women I know. So just thank you. I'm sure you hear it all the time, but here's one more person.
That's not something that I mind hearing. I'm very grateful. Thank you, Karen.
Yes. My question is, on the cynical side, I got married at 35 later in life to a man I knew for 5 years who I considered my best friend and the love of my life, and I happen to line up with what you mentioned earlier. I'm depressed, I've abused alcohol, and I'm overweight.
Oh, sweetie, I'm sorry.
I, in some ways, am happier than ever and more miserable.
Welcome to the human contradiction.
And my question to you is, I'm interested when I, like with your book, it brings open a topic with friends, and I find we're all miserable in a way. And I'm curious, is there a silver lining? What is your advice to other cynical, you know?
Oh, Karen. All right. Well, listen, first of all, we're all grown-ups here. So let's just be honest and say there are paradoxes. All right, we'll start with that in life. And the second thing that I'm going to say in terms of your statement about your friends being miserable, I think that we must cut ourselves a bit of slack here. And I'm speaking now about women of our generation, by which I mean any woman born in the last 75 years. We are standing at the forefront of a massive and totally unprecedented social science experiment that has no history whatsoever until extremely recently. The autonomy, the financial independence, the vast number of choices that women are given, the education, the independence, the control over our biological destinies, the political power, all of this stuff is brand new. And we feel sometimes, I think, like rats in a maze trying to sort out this brand new radical experiment. And I feel like I look at all my friends and we're all sort of blindly moving through this maze and knocking into walls every once in a while and saying, whoop, wrong way, back up, and going in the other direction and then pushing a lever and saying, is this a pleasure response? Oh, nope, suffering, sorry, back up. And it's worth it, is what I'm saying, because if you in your misery start to feel at all nostalgic for a time when life was simpler, I would ask you to speak to a woman who came from a, quote, simpler culture and ask her whether she recommends that you trade it up. Mm. We are the first wave, all of us. And the thing that I think differentiates my life, for instance, from my grandmother's life, who was a Depression-era farm wife in Minnesota, was that while her life was more difficult in terms of suffering at every possible level, she was not neurotic. She had no choices. She didn't have to wake up in the middle of the night and wonder, should I have gotten married? Should I have been a photographer? Should I have gone to graduate school? She didn't have that. That is the one thing that differentiates us. And while we often sort of ridicule that indecision because it seems weak and almost silly compared to the luxuries that we have in our lives, don't take it lightly. It's a lot to deal with. So you're in good company. Hang in there. It's worth it to be where we are right now.
I like your words. Hang in there. Elizabeth Gilbert, her new book is titled Committed. When we come back, more of your thoughts. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. By the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By Jeffrey Kenner, in appreciation of NPR's international coverage and its foreign correspondents. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Many musicians and music fans, including those of us at Fresh Air, are mourning the death of songwriter and singer Vic Chestnut. He died Christmas Day at the age of 45. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with friends and musicians who worked with him. Guitarist Guy Picciotto, Michael Stipe of REM, and producer Jem Cohen. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. And as you know, Elizabeth Gilbert wrote a wonderful first book titled Eat, Pray, Love. She's now written what I think is going to be a second big hit. It's titled Committed, A Skeptic Makes Peace with Marriage. Let's go back to the phones to Salt Lake City Good morning, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thank you for calling my taking my call.
Surely.
I'm 55, screaming inside, been in a marriage for 26 years, and it's just miserable. Oh. And I just feel like I'm just this screaming woman that is in this maze that, like, your author talked about in the other call.
Sarah, I ask you a question?
Uh-huh.
Have you had any sort of counseling, either individually or with your husband?
Individually, I have.
Good. I'm glad. Okay. Sorry to interrupt. Just wanted to know.
That's fine. I just feel like I'm setting a bad example for my daughter, who is, 18, and seeing me so miserable, thinking, I just feel so helpless. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering, how did your author decide leaving? How do you just say, this is it? I'm kind of dependent on my husband for financial reasons, but I'm just kind of screaming inside.
But that's kind of important, isn't it?
The financial question is huge, Sarah.
There
used to be an adage, and it's still largely true in this country, that the average woman is one divorce away from bankruptcy. And still, when people get divorced, when women get divorced in America, their incomes drop by 30% immediately. Still, even today when most women are working outside the home. So there are huge financial costs. And I think one of the things that we forget about marriage, when especially, somebody your daughter's age, for instance, thinking about somebody she might like to marry, is that this is a financial contract of the highest order with the enormous consequences.
Sarah, do you have personal income of your own, or are you totally dependent on your husband?
I have personal income of my own. I've worked my whole married life. So,
Well, that's good.
I'm first of all, I'm so sorry to hear you say this, and I'm sorry for your story and the stories of anybody who is in a situation like yours. What you're feeling is typical of people who are going through bad marriages or contemplating divorce. I was startled and dismayed to see that on the stress indicating list that doctors use to indicate, the chances of people having stress-related illness, the first most stress-inducing event in a person's life is the death of a spouse. The second is divorce. And that goes above death of a child, if you can imagine. It is so, and the reason that it's so distressing is because of the ambivalence that you're describing. You're torn in two different directions. There is no answer. There is no right way to go. You can look. I spent months before I got my divorce talking to every single person I knew, married, divorced, single, remarried, trying to find somebody whose life mirrored mine enough that they could just say, this is what you can do. Here is your answer. And I've had people say this to me. They've come up to me and said, I'm miserable. Should I get a divorce? I don't know, and you don't. You don't know either. And I think that the most important thing you have to do for yourself right now is take very, very, very good care of yourself, because you are at the risk of coming down with stress-related illnesses and really doing damage not only to yourself and to your children.
Sarah, thanks for sharing.
So good luck to you, and I'm sorry I don't have the answer, but blessings to you.
Now, here's an email from Michelle. She wants to know about the book review this morning in today's Washington Post. The reviewer noted your Western-centric questioning techniques in Asia, and Michelle goes on to say, I wonder whether she sees this as an issue in her writing?
I wouldn't know how to be anything but Western-centric.
How do you do anything?
You know what? I've never believed in objectivity in a way, in terms of, especially when it comes to writing a memoir. And as I said in the beginning of this book, I tried to make it really clear in the introduction that the research that I've done reflects very much my own culture. And part of the reason was that it's such an enormous subject, and for me to have taken on the question of marriage all over the world, just to try to dissect Muslim women's relationships to marriage, would have taken me years of academic study. So I was trying to put it in the context. I say this in the book. I was trying to discover what my inherited prejudices, fears, and desires about marriage were and where they came from. So it is indeed an extremely Western-centric point of view. It made for some comedy in the book when I was interviewing women like the peasant women I met in the north of Vietnam who were from the Hmong clan, and I would ask them these daytime TV American questions like, when did you know he was the one? And, you know, what's the secret to it? And they were laughing at me as hard as you're laughing at me, Diane.
Laughing.
They were like,
exactly.
What are you on about, lady? But I put that in the book simply to highlight the fact that the assumptions and ideas that we might have in the modern West are not universal.
Let's go to David, who's in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Good morning.
Greetings from Fort Lauderdale, both of you. Yeah, weather's cold, but not as above zero.
Yeah, you bet.
Yeah, the sun's out, so it's not so bad. This is quite an interesting topic. I'm 51 and single. I've never been married. And I'm not gay. I don't mean that in a bad way, but
fair enough.
Like it was mentioned earlier, this is basically a new era of relationships. I think a lot of women and men have went the marriage route on the premise that that's what their parents did, mm-hmm. and that's what they were supposed to do. And we're different, you know. Mm-hmm. We're our whole society, the way that we think is different. And I think there's nothing worse, and I have plenty of women friends, and some of them are married, to see how they've lost themselves. Mm. You know, they've lost touch of who they were or who they are, mm-hmm. or maybe they don't even know anymore who mm-hmm. they are. And I can imagine how that would equate in such a huge amount of internal frustration. Mm-hmm. That would be difficult to break free of. The other issue I see, like it was just mentioned, with married women that are extremely financially dependent on their husband, mm-hmm. and their husbands are, if you divorce me, you're not going to get anything. And that kind of fear, it seems to me, from what I understand from talking to other women that are in that situation, puts them in a position where it just exasperates the whole thing. And it's sad to see, you know, it's sad to see people, especially women in the sensitivity, mm-hmm. lose who they are. I mean,
Well, women tend to see themselves and they define and judge themselves in terms of their connectivity. And so it's really easy, I think, for women. I think we all know this anecdotally, to disappear into somebody else and put other people's needs ahead of them. It's what makes women wonderful. It's also what makes women vulnerable. But I do love the old adage, autonomy is the god of woman. And it does seem to be the solution through all this. The other thing that you make that's an interesting point is to talk about the difference in the way that we see marriage now than in the past. And anthropologists talk about the evolution from pragmatic marriage, which is marriage based on what's good for the general community, to what they call autonomistic or individualistic or even expressive marriage, which is people choosing a marriage based on what's good for their own needs of their own heart. My sister and I have actually just invented a new term that we think is the future, at least in the United States. It's called wifeless marriage. And it seems to be that a lot of thinking women that I know would really like to get married, but none of them would like to be a wife. And actually, their husbands don't want to be the wife either. It just seems like the short straw to draw in history is to be the wife with everything that entails about what you give up for the rest of the family. And so I see a lot of couples trying to figure out how to negotiate some sort of a marriage where nobody has to be the wife. And because frankly, except for a few people who are really suited to it, it's not a terrific job that a lot of people really love and revere. I do think that's the future.
Here's an email from Lynn who's says, in my family of six, two of us women are divorced. All three of us women married at 20. I'm 65 this year, she says. Now I'm remarried just 2 years ago after being with my man for 23 years.
Oh, I wish I knew why she, did she say why she got married?
She says, we waited to make sure. No, we married when he would have minor surgery and we realized we could fall into one of those mm-hmm. situations where unmarriage is not recognized by institutions.
So she got married for the same reasons that I did, that it's because we were
the
stubborn.
The state says you got to do something.
And you know, I think that that's a pretty good definition of what marriage has been in the past. People stubbornly insist on having intimacy with each other. You cannot have intimacy without privacy. You cannot have privacy without rights. And you cannot have rights often without marriage.
And here's another perspective from Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning, Diana.
Good morning. I certainly appreciate you taking my call.
Surely.
This is very interesting. I was struck, Elizabeth, by your discussion about when you came back into the States with Felipe and how lame it sounded when you called him as your boyfriend. And my partner and I have been together for 20 years here in Charlotte. I'm gay, and we cannot get married. But mm-hmm. we have two friends in Boston who have also been together for 20 years and recently got married, mm-hmm. and they've always felt very strong about their relationship, very committed, mm-hmm. but they said they were surprised at the sense of legitimacy mm-hmm. that being married gave their relationship. They said they couldn't describe it until it actually happened.
That's a very, very well taken point. And I, you know, when you are not given the right to marriage or you don't marriage, there is that sort of semantic question about how are you going to introduce this person
yeah.
that gives a sense of the honor in with which you hold each other. Partner, friend, partner is a corporate term,
yeah,
you
exactly.
know, and it's you know, I'm also very sorry to hear that you don't have the right to get married. And I hope that that's coming to you soon. In fact, I trust that it is.
Indeed, more and more states.
Yeah. It's the inevitable next wave of marriage, but your point is really well taken, because in America especially, the terms husband and wife carry this enormous social reverence. It's interesting to note that in Western Europe, gay couples have no comprehension of why Americans are fighting so hard, gay Americans, for the right to marry, because marriage isn't fetishized there the way that it is here, and they're perfectly happy to have equal civil unions. In fact, amusingly, in France, when they passed legislation to give equal civil unions, they created this other kind of marriage called civil union for gay couples. Hundreds of thousands of straight couples signed up for it, precisely because they didn't want the archaic language of marriage. But here, it still does give you a heavy weight. It's like you get to cut to the front of the line.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now to Robert, who's in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I went to visit a week or two ago. I've never read the books before, who is recently broken up from her relationship, and actually stumbled into your books, ended up reading them this week, and really was fascinated by your latest one, Committed. Just a background, I was married when I was very, very young and have been a single person pretty much my entire adult life, so I sort of watch all of this from sort of the sidelines, although I've been in a number of relationships. And I think one of the things when I was reading your book that I thought about is the fact that really what it seems like you're getting at is the whole idea of how we tend to hang our idea of happiness on our relationship to another person.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the thing that I think about in my own life, and I sort of wanted your input upon this, because you know, I think that there's nothing more wonderful than being in a committed relationship, and nothing worse than to be in a bad one.
Mm-hmm.
And but in the real sense that, to me at least, happiness has to really, in some ways, like you said, I think the key word is balance. It has to be a balance between your relationship with other and at the same time your principal relationship being to yourself. And I'd like more
Rock
comments
on, Robert.
About this.
Thank you for making that point. You know, I've discovered a lot when I was researching about what I call the soulmate paradox, this a word that I'm so allergic to at this point, the idea of the dream of finding a soulmate, you know, the dream of completion through another person, and the Jerry Maguire fantasy that somebody will look at you and say, you complete me. I refuse to burden my current husband with the obligation of completing me. I have taken that responsibility for myself. It doesn't mean he is off the hook. It doesn't mean he has no obligations to me. If he neglects me or abuses me, obviously that relationship will end. But I come to him with my owning my own incompletions.
And finally, to Granville, Michigan. Good morning, Carla.
Hello, Diane and guests. Interesting conversation this morning.
Good.
I just have a comment. I'm 60 years old, have never been married, and I never really felt the need to be married. Maybe when I was younger, I always thought, you know, the soulmate sort of thing, but now that I'm way beyond that, it's kind of a moot point. But, you know, I was very independent and just always thought for myself, and I just refused to cater to the expectations of society.
All right. Thank you for sharing that. You're a little bit ahead of your time there, Carla. I'm delighted to hear your story. It's funny. It reminds me of a friend whose beloved auntie just died. She was 90 years old, and she was this gorgeous, stunning, glamorous woman. She always looked about 20 years younger than her age, and she said the secret to her happiness and to her health and her beauty was that she put Vaseline on her face every night, and she never married.
Isn't that interesting? The thoughts about marriage and how, as you said, at the outset of this program, they really are changing.
Mm-hmm.
The ideas, the ideals. And if we can just get young women to stop concentrating on the day instead of the lifetime, I think it might work a lot better.
I hope so.
I hope so, too. Elizabeth Gilbert, this is a wonderful book. Congratulations.
Thank you, Diane. It's been a joy talking to you.
The book is titled Committed, A Skeptic Makes Peace with Marriage. And Elizabeth Gilbert is also the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Eat, Pray, Love, which stayed on the list for over 100 weeks. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.